We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Next report at 4:30 this afternoon during All Things Considered.
This weather forecast is made possible with support from the University of Illinois Employees Credit Union, a member-owned and not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to serve the complete financial needs of its members. The University of Illinois Employees Credit Union. Information is available on the web at uiecu.org.
A storm system developing in the southern plains will spread rain into northeast Missouri and southwest Illinois this afternoon. As the system tracks east, it is expected to spread showers across the southern half of Illinois tonight and tomorrow. A strong northerly flow will develop behind this system, bringing brisk and chilly conditions to the Midwest at midweek. Highs today will range from the upper 50s in Iowa to near 70 degrees in southern Indiana. Lows tonight will range from the mid-30s across Iowa to the low 50s in western Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny with a chance of isolated showers, the high 62. The wind out of the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, the low 40. The wind will be out of the northwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny and cooler with a chance of rain, the high 52. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy. We'll see a low in the upper 30s. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Look for a high in the low 50s. The wind will be out of the north from 15 to 20 miles per hour. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s. Thursday and Thursday night, partly cloudy. The high Thursday will be in the low 50s, and the low Thursday night will be in the low 30s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. Western and southern Illinois seeing clouds. Elsewhere, sunshine was reported. At Rockford, 54 degrees. O'Hare Airport reported 55 degrees. It was 57 at Bloomington, 59 at Mattoon, 65 at Carbondale. At South Bend, 55 degrees. Lafayette, 59. In Indianapolis and Terre Haute, it was 57 degrees. Willard Airport reported 60 degrees at the top of the hour. The sky partly sunny. The dew point 29. The relative humidity 30%. The wind out of the west at 10. The barometric pressure 29.98 and steady. And at 12:40, 59 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. In southwest Alaska, officials are counting votes on a controversial initiative to stop an open-pit copper and gold mine. If passed, the initiative could stop the developers from getting permits they need to start digging at the Pebble Mine. The mine's location near the spawning grounds for the largest sockeye salmon runs in the world worries conservation groups, commercial fishermen, and sport fishers. Daisha Eaton of NPR member station KDLG has more.
The only way to get to the site of the Pebble Mine is by helicopter. It touches down on a hill overlooking state land about 200 miles southwest of Anchorage. We're surrounded by rolling tundra threaded by glistening streams. The Pebble Partnership, the group developing the mine, has drilled more than 1,200 exploratory holes.
We're at 3,700 feet right now.
Bud Verzier is a mine worker.
We start off the hole fresh water. We mix a little bit of drilling mud, and we pump it down the hole. Otherwise, it'd get too hot, and you couldn't drill.
The piece of desolate tundra could be worth billions of dollars in copper, gold, and the precious metal molybdenum used in electronics manufacturing. A citizens initiative in the borough closest to the mine site wants to end the drilling. One of the people trying to stop the development is Catherine Karskallen, who lives downriver from the proposed mine. She's a third-generation fisherman who also works for a conservation group. She created a YouTube video showing photos of green and orange goo oozing from an old drill hole at the site, with captions explaining that Pebble's already polluting. The video is set to a song by Zebrahead.
Well, these are pictures that I took up on the Pebble deposit. My coworker and I flew up and we came across one of the reclaimed drill sites.
Recently, a Superior Court judge ruled that conservation groups had not provided enough evidence to prove Pebble was already polluting.
A crane, all five species of salmon.
And where'd you catch this salmon?
Right down here on the Wood River.
Pete Andrew is giving me a tour of his freezer. He's a commercial fisherman. Andrew's also an Alaska native who fishes for his own food.
This is the last place in the Western world that man hasn't wrecked yet. And I'll do whatever it takes to stop it.
Environmentalists and commercial fishermen have received a lot of help from Bob Gillum. He's a sport fisher and widely considered the richest man in Alaska. Gillum's favorite place to drop his line is at his private lodge nearby the proposed Pebble project. Gillum put up about $400,000 to get the initiative on the ballot.
This mine will dig up miles of salmon-producing creeks and rivers. And that's exactly what the Save Our Salmon initiative is all about.
While the mine could hurt some fishermen, it could benefit Alaska natives living in villages close to the site. Trifon Anguson is with the group which represents the Alaska natives closest to Pebble. He opposes the initiative for several reasons.
There are no jobs, and schools are closing, and once the schools close, the young people move away and the village doesn't grow, and then people have lost their language, they've lost their culture.
Environmental trade-offs may be needed, Anguson says, because the jobs that would be created by the mine may be the key to keeping the remote Alaska Native villages and culture alive. Regardless of whether the initiative passes, the losing side will likely challenge the result in the Alaska Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Alaska.
Nathaniel Philbrick loves Moby Dick.
I think it's as close to being our American Bible as we have.
He's written a book about it.
The book is full of almost chapters that are sidebars that can be kind of frustrating if you're trying to follow the plot, but which lead into wormholes of just metaphysical poetry.
Why read Moby Dick? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
It's 12:45. For baseball fans, their love for the game goes beyond the current season and back through its history. It was that love of baseball history that brought 100 people to Chicago's Wrigley Field over the weekend. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert was among those in the crowd.
John Dietrich came to his first Cubs game at Wrigley Field when he was a kid.
I came here first time in 1956. I was 6 years old. Sat in the upper deck up there. It was a doubleheader against Cincinnati.
The suburban Lombard resident was back at the ballpark, not for a game, but a panel discussion about the game and its history held as part of Chicago Ideas Week. Panelists made their remarks from atop the Cubs' dugout with their backs to the third baseline. Dietrich says even after half a century of rooting for the Cubs, the panel taught him things he didn't know about the stadium and its namesake, chewing gum magnate P.K. Wrigley.
It's very interesting. Wrigley was the consummate businessman. He got the biggest, best naming rights deal in all of pro sports. Paid nothing. Wrigley gum.
John doesn't remember the entire lineup at his first game, but one name stands out, Ernie Banks. On Saturday, the Hall of Fame shortstop and first baseman shared memories of P.K. Wrigley, player-manager Phil Cavaretta, and his own major league debut, a 16-4 loss to the Phillies at Wrigley in 1953.
We had lost 10 straight. So my first appearance and walking into this field, we were losing. And in my mind, I say, you don't have to win to win. In my own mind, you don't have to win to win. What do you mean by that? I say to myself, you can win the respect of the fans, the writers, your family. That kind of winning lasts longer. I mean, even after you have retired or gone on.
Mr. Cub was one of seven guest lecturers who stepped on the small stage to talk about their role in preserving the game. Major League Baseball historian John Thorne says his purpose is for everyone to understand how we can use its history to build emotional, social, and cultural connections. He's chairing a committee on the origins of the game, which Thorne says stretch back to before the 1800s.
Jeffrey C. Ward, with whom I worked happily on Ken Burns' 1994 documentary, Baseball, said in later years, "Working on the film and book taught me that while most Americans care too little about their history, the baseball community is different. The real meaning of all those apparently impenetrable stats is that the past matters. Without them, no player would know where he stood, no fan could measure his or her heroes against those who have gone before."
Serving with Thorne on the committee to research baseball's ancestry is University of Illinois history professor Adrian Burgos. His emphasis includes Cubans who sent their kids to study in the U.S. in the 1860s and started playing baseball back home in the Caribbean, bringing the game back just as Japanese players would many years later. Burgos notes that baseball, at this level, was always racially inclusive.
The experience of playing in the Dominican Republic or in Mexico or in Cuba for African Americans and black players in general was one they got to play for the first time as professional in an integrated setting. I remember the words of Roy Campanella, who was asked, as he's beginning to integrate baseball, the first black catcher to play in the major leagues, about, you know, would the white pitchers pitch to him? And he said, "Of course. I've caught him in Cuba. I've caught him in Mexico. I've caught him all over. Baseball's baseball."
Major League Hall of Famer Dave Winfield was also on the panel. Now an executive with the San Diego Padres, he says baseball's history provides a context for honoring the heroes of the game.
Each year we honor the guys and ladies from the Negro Leagues, and they're getting older. And we're just trying to find ways to make sure that people remember that thread that they are in that whole tapestry of baseball in America. I'm trying to think of permanent ways to give them recognition and honor while they're still alive.
It's an odd thing in and of itself to be in Wrigley Field in mid-October. The Cubs division champion teams of 2007 and 8 didn't win a single playoff game, and fans don't need to be reminded of what happened in 2003. But for one morning, a visit to the ballpark wasn't about a curse or whether Boston Red Sox executive Theo Epstein is the man to break it. It's about the game of baseball and why we've preserved it for more than 150 years. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media.
For a slideshow of pictures from Saturday's event at Wrigley Field, visit our website, will.illinois.edu.
You may have heard us talk about the importance of our member match fund. Well, there's still time for you to help build the fund before the Power Hour begins on October 20th. Because a successful Power Hour leads to a successful pledge drive. Mail a check today to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 17th of October, 2011.